Time passes and our eyes are opened, or maybe they should be. It's not often due to some nefarious reason, but in education, the more time that passes, the more society changes, the more research that it's done, the more we realize that we were doing something so very wrong. When it comes to teaching our pre-service teachers, everything being done at WCU Vancouver is done from a lens of social justice and equity. That certainly holds true for Shamim Raka, who last year won the Chancellor's Award for Advancing Equity. We talked to Shamim about teaching classroom management, teaching things within a cultural context, and how we can ensure that we continue improving on the practices of the past. Education Eclipse starts now.
Education, news, and research. These are the conversations happening inside education, athletic training, sports science, and sport management that are going to transform each. It's Education Eclipse from Washington State University.
Here on Education Eclipse, and I'm joined by Shamim Raka, an assistant professor of teaching and learning here on the WCU Vancouver campus. Shamim, thank you so much for joining me. It was the first time I think I've really been able to go into one of your classes and observe you teaching students who ultimately will become teachers, so they're pre-service teachers. And first of all, I just got to tell you, it was really entertaining. I thought you were a great teacher.
Thank you.
So I just want to work through the stuff that you were talking about today with them and then have that dovetail into some of your research.
Well, I'm teaching the classroom management class, and that's what I was teaching this morning. And it's very important for me to couch everything within a cultural context. So I'm trying to teach them not to manage students, but rather manage themselves and manage the classroom in a way that's culturally responsive and sustaining. And so today we are talking about setting expectations and really thinking about what it is we want our students to not only accomplish, but how we want them to get there. So they were doing some group work thinking about the kind of classroom expectations that they'd have. And that led to some really rich conversations because everybody really had different ideas and they had to come together on an agreement of what they would expect. And we saw some themes like respect and responsibility, safety, but also inclusivity, which I was excited to see because every group had some form of inclusivity, and that's something that we talk a lot about, that the traditional classroom doesn't fit all needs. And having the exact same, you know, we want to have expectations, high expectations of students, but we have to recognize that those might look differently depending on the student. And so the classroom may not look exactly like they remember their classrooms looking. So I was excited to see that was a part of their expectations.
It was easy to see when you went around to the different groups, the manner in which they dealt with situations that had come up in classrooms, and you could tell that when you're talking inclusivity, there are a lot of different ideas because of different backgrounds that folks come from, different races, ethnicities, sexual orientations. It was really pretty astounding. And you talk about a management perspective. How do we incorporate that into the classroom in a way that's respectful? That's not an easy task.
No, it's an incredibly complex task, and I think it's getting harder because the more we know, the more we know what we've been doing wrong. So I think it is more complex, and it's something that the students are really frightened about. It's something they worry a lot about. They're trying to balance what they know and what they've experienced with what they're seeing when they're out in the classrooms today. And it's a different world.
When you talk about building students up for success, what about student behavior? I mean, how do we hold students accountable to these high expectations that we say that we have while still being able to hold, you know, their humanity, like do both of those things? Because that is a huge complexity. And I mean, how do we do that? Because often we just think about discipline, you know, the word discipline. And I know how you feel about that, but maybe you can share with the listener, how do we do all that?
Well, I think that we start with human rights. And we understand human rights, and we start with understanding what's happening in society and how it's changing. With my students, I think the most important thing I teach them is their own culture. I teach them to be aware of their own biases, both implicit and explicit, and to understand how what they think is right and wrong and why, so that when they approach a situation with a student, they can ask themselves, is this because of something I'm doing? Rather than just pointing to the student. That's where that discipline versus management comes in. Because management is about controlling yourself, controlling your classroom, being an exciting, engaging teacher. It's about the curriculum that you use and how you choose to use it. It's about how you set up your students for success in terms of letting them know clearly what the expectations are, what that looks like, right? So it's not only I expect you to be quiet, but what does quiet sound like? Because in different cultures, quiet is different. In different cultures, caring is different. So it's about knowing yourself and how you think about these things. So they do exhaustive work on themselves. They probably spend 2 or 3 hours thinking about their own culture and different aspects of their culture, both implicit and explicit culture. And they also do a lot of work around the expectations that they hold and what those look like so that they can clearly define those for students, so that students know and they're not taken unaware. There's some good examples. I think that volume is a really good example. People get really caught up on having this quiet classroom. But that stems from a belief that you as teacher are sage on stage and have all this knowledge to impart. Well, we know, A, that's not the best way to teach, and B, that it only works with some students. And so you're setting your students up for failure if you're only teaching in a way that requires students to sit down, be quiet, look at you, and listen, right? So I teach them different ways of, we talk about teaching in many different ways, as facilitator, as allowing students to construct their own knowledge. So those will be more flexible type spaces. They won't demand that attention paying that lecture demands. Plus, we're talking about children here, right? So I think also I teach my students to get to know their students deeply and not to make assumptions. So it's really easy to say, well, my Latino students will do X, and so I should therefore do Y. My Black students will do X, I should therefore do Y. But that's a logical fallacy in and of itself, because we're grouping people. And to say all Latinos have the same culture and cultural aspects and look at the world and experience the world in the same way is grossly wrong. It just will not work. So I try to get them to understand they need to know their students deeply and care about them deeply. And that, because caring is cultural, they may have to act in a different way toward one student's toward another in order for them to know that they're cared for. So if we start with love, a radical idea in the classroom these days, you know, really loving your students, you can't really love them as if they're your own child, which is where my research is going. You can't do that unless you really know them. So it's learning about them in nuanced form every day.
Of course, we have so many students, though, in a classroom, and something that I really respect for teachers who want to be caring and get to know their students. But to get to know that nuance, I mean, how do you even do that when you have X number of students? There's so many.
Right. Well, so what research is telling us is that if there is a cultural mismatch between teachers and students, then the student who's feeling culturally mismatched, who is culturally mismatched, so they see and experience the world in a different way than their teacher. So those students are going to be the ones you really need to get to know. Because those students who you have cultural congruence with, right? So you share, the way things are done at home and for a child are very similar to how they're done in the classroom. That's where you get cultural congruence, right? So the children aren't always trying to figure out what they're supposed to be doing. They just know what they're supposed to be doing to be in line with the teacher's culture. So it's not that you have to get to know every student this way. And then you're gonna have students who, for whatever reason in their lives, even if they're not culturally matched to you, they're gonna be just fine. They will have somehow learned, maybe it's through schooling, right, what is expected of them, and that's going to be similar across teachers. I mean, we've got a growing cultural mismatch between teachers and students, and it's not just about race. It's about culture here, and that's individual. But it does make a difference that students are racially mismatched, because race has such a power in our society, and it so profoundly impacts our students or people's experience, particularly people of color or other marginalized groups.
Right, and we certainly identify with that culture. But I do think of those that maybe a student is culturally congruent with you, but they have other factors at play. Maybe there's some emotional, social, developmental disabilities or other things that you may understand the cultural nuances, but there's something else in that child's life, right? Is there any kind of difference, I guess, with age? So what level of class you're teaching, if it's a high school versus something elementary school? I mean, what's the variation in the way a teacher handles that or gets to know a child and really get to know those nuances? I mean, I worry nowadays, you know, that a lot of times, you know, teachers they're in a situation where some of them are told they shouldn't get to separate that fourth wall or whatever you're calling it, because then that's inappropriate, right? It's inappropriate to be overstep your bounds and be involved in that child's life. Is that just a travesty or I mean, what do you think?
I don't think it's going to do us any good. I'm working with a team of middle school teachers right now. I'll get back to your question. But I'm working with a team of middle school teachers doing anti-racism education with them, their professional development. And I was talking with some Latina teachers, and they're saying their district has called for them to not step that boundary, right? They're pulling the boundaries in much tighter so that the teachers can't do the kinds of things that they've always done. And they were talking to me about how they have to at times drive children somewhere in order for them to get there. The parents can't do it. That within the Latina population, within that family structure, the teacher has a very different role. And they were asking, how do we do that? And how do we maintain those relationships if we can't do those things we've always done? That, you know, we go out into the community. And that's something I always urge my people I work with to do. Go to church, go to basketball games, go out into the community and be with your students. To get to your question of developmental appropriateness here, your young people, your kindergartners through probably second grade, I would say in my experience, probably can't articulate their culture, right? They can't articulate necessarily why they're doing what they're doing. But I think you learn a lot from students by the questions that they ask, by listening to those very carefully, and by watching their behavior. And so for the younger people, I think it's about observation. It's also about talking with parents. And I like to send out surveys to parents and have them tell me about their child. I specifically ask the question, what can you tell me about your child that will help me be a better teacher for them? And using that parent as an asset, like really seeing parents as an asset rather than as deficit, because we tend to do that as well as teachers. But I think as the children get older, they're able to tell you why they're acting the way that they are, and we can learn so much about that. And the fact that you care enough to ask them, right? So instead of, I'm going to punish you because you just chose to break my rule, we say, I see you're struggling here. What do you need? What's going on? Right? That's a very different contextualization of that issue. And plus, you're building relationship at the same time because you're showing, you're noticing. You're not just blaming, right? Because the reality is, critical theory would tell us that it's not just the student who's at, there are other problems in our school system that can be leading to the problem the student is experiencing. So if you've got a student acting out, for instance, it could be because of a myriad of problems. It could be your own teaching. You could be boring, boring, boring. They can perceive you as not caring, even though, of course, you care, you're a teacher. But you might not be showing your care in a way that they can read, right? So it could be the system. It could be that they showed up late to school that day, and your school has a policy that says if you're late, you don't get breakfast, right? Which schools sometimes have. So the kid could be hungry, you know? There are dozens of factors. It could be something that happened at home that's being brought forth into school. How do you know that unless you ask the question?
I'm like a bear. Don't withhold food from me. I will get hangry.
I will too.
Let's segue just a little bit. Tell me about the Native American Library Project. I'd like to know a little bit more about that so we can increase the message on that.
Sure. I'd love to increase the message on that. It's so important. We were given a small grant from the state legislature to do some work around the Since Time Immemorial curriculum. And that was a fairly short window. And so what I decided to do after talking with some Native elders, as we are on Indigenous land, we have several tribes that we work with and that I glean so much information from and wisdom from. We decided that what would be helpful for teachers would be to build a library of books written by Indigenous folks for kindergarten, to be used in kindergarten through 12th grade classrooms. So what I did was I put out to my Native elder partners the need for titles, because I don't even know what titles to purchase. And so through social media, we garnered a long list of books that people thought would be great for kindergarten through 12th grade students. And we used a graduate assistant in the library sciences department who just really carefully went through each and every one of those books, summarized them, found out who the author was and what their tribal affiliation was. If there was no tribal affiliation, book was popped out. Also, Debbie Reese is a known Indigenous scholar. She's Navajo. She's someone whose daughter I taught 20 years ago. Yeah, and she has a blog on Native American children's literature. So this graduate assistant went through each and every book and made sure that Debbie had recommended or strongly recommended each of these books. So we were able to get 17 titles, ranging from picture books through high school level novels. A few are nonfiction texts. And what I did was purchased classroom sets of each of those books. So teachers in the community can get a library card for our, because we're a public institution, they can come get a library card, and they can check out 25 copies of the Indigenous People's History of the United States, for instance. What's another title? I Am Not a Number, which is a beautiful picture book about children being taken from their home to be put in boarding schools. And so
that's strong stuff.
It is amazing stuff. And what I'm doing now is that in each of my courses, one day is spent, and I teach kindergarten through 12th grade. I teach in the elementary and secondary program. So it's great because I got all the books covered. One day, all my students get together in groups and they do kind of a literature circle around the book. And then they write a summary of the book. And then they write a set of questions. And those are going to be in each book so that when teachers check them out, they'll have access to a quick and easy curricular piece. And so my students are getting engaged with the books, therefore hopefully they'll use them later, they'll be more familiar with them, use them later in their careers. And then the teachers who come to get the books will have a tool besides the books themselves. So I'm real excited about it, and we've had people starting to check them out, but they're mostly students here on campus so far.
We are trying to decrease this gap that exists between students and teachers who look and sound like them, right? A lot of that research is coming right out of here, out of WC Vancouver. Tell me about some of your students. I mean, I saw a few of them. I've met with a few of them already today. There's more coming up at a class you're teaching. And you've got some fantastic pre-service teachers.
I do. I have a lot of students who are what I would call non-traditional. So although I've got probably half the students are what you'd expect, 19 to 22-year-old students. This year in particular, I've got a much more diverse, non-traditional group. So of the half that's not the traditional white female student, young, I've got students who are in DACA. I've got students who are parents. I've got students who are single parents, which is interesting. I've got students who are my age. So we've got a more diverse population of students this year, and that's really exciting to me. I understand historically why, for one thing, our region is predominantly white, although the university is shifting in demographics as well, which is also very exciting to me. And it presents unique challenges. But the students who are coming seem, particularly my students of color that are in the program and those who are parents themselves, they have a passion that is remarkable. And they're coming to the teaching profession understanding already that it's political. In my past, I've been a teacher for now 25, 27 years, a long time. And I've never known people to understand how political our jobs are, but they are. And so these students, I don't have to bear the burden of...
They know what they're getting into.
Yes, exactly. Because often it's this sheer shock when I start talking about the world that they're entering. Right. But with these students, it's not. And so I think that's what you're reading when you're seeing that critique. You're seeing that level of student who's coming here saying, I've got a really important job to do here. And it's not just to teach kids, right? It is to engage in a making the world a better place for all people.
Yeah, I was very impressed with some of the students that I met today. And, you know, I just thought I would throw that out there, that Vancouver is producing some great students. And they're obviously getting well prepared by you and by other faculty members that are here. So kudos on that.
We're trying. I mean, our goal is social justice here. So we understand our mission's greater. It's not just about teaching people to be good pedagogues.
Anything else you would like to add? I mean, at the risk of just handing an open mic over to you, I'd feel remiss if I didn't, see if there's anything you wanted to touch base on what you're researching about, here at WC Vancouver, anything like that.
Well, I would say that I'm very excited about a gift we were just given by the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. It was a payout from their casino, actually. So it's the first year that they've made money, and they've got a contract or something with the state where they have to give some of that money to the community. And I have been working for about 4 years with one of the tribal council members, Carissa Lowe, to create a structure for a curriculum for the Cowlitz tribe, which is the largest serving tribe in terms of the since time immemorial curriculum. It's the largest serving tribe in the state. So they service more districts. They're the closest federally recognized tribe in the state of Washington to the largest number of districts. Yet they do not have a reservation. They do not have an education team. They are decentered because they don't have a reservation. So they're scattered throughout the Northwest and beyond. So they don't have the ability to create this curriculum, which is mandated by the state, on their own. So they gave me this gift to create a curriculum about the peoples of the Lower Columbia Tribe, peoples of the Lower Columbia River. And so that includes tribes that are not federally recognized because they recognize the injustice of that part of the law. And so I'm going to be working, Steve Fountain, who's a history professor here, and who's the head of Native American programs here, we're going to work together to hire a team of students who will then be professionally trained to use recording equipment and in interviewing techniques. We're going to spread them out throughout the state to go speak with elders and other tribal members about their histories, their stories, their ways of knowing and being, their artwork, their work, the effect of damming on their salmon. We want their stories because we can't write a curriculum. We don't have any wisdom. So we'll go in with cultural humility, hope to learn as much as we can, and then I'll work with volunteers here in the College of Education, kindergarten through 12th grade students, so teacher candidates, who have volunteered to come and help me write the curriculum. So I'm just seeing, with work like this, I see so many benefits. I see benefits for our students who will learn, again, cultural humility. They'll learn about the tribe, and they'll learn about that history, and then they'll learn curriculum writing. I see K-12 teachers benefiting because they'll have an actual curriculum to use, because right now they don't know. We don't know a lot about the Cowlitz people. That information has not been gathered together. It's in bits and spurts places, but it's hard to find. And there's not enough elders to go around to come to your school, right? So, and then I also see the benefit to the students we hire who may not be educators themselves or future educators, but we are hoping to hire Native students to learn these skills of interviewing, cultural sensitivity, and technology use and editing skills to go out and learn this information. So they'll learn the information, but they'll also learn those skills. And they'll have these valuable skills. So, and then we're helping the tribe because they're getting the information out about their tribe so that the children who are in the community can learn about themselves within the school. They can see themselves reflected in the schools. And also, the money's going to go towards, yes, paying our students, but for resources and for a workshop for teachers and for the curriculum development piece. But it's also going to be going back into the community because we'll pay the elders, we'll pay the tribal members to share their wisdom, because that time and that knowledge is really valuable. So I'm really excited about that project.
I have no doubt that your students will be able to figure it out. If I can figure out the technology, I think anybody can. This isn't just important work you're doing. This is vital. I really appreciate you sitting down. And I'm excited because once we stop record here, I'm going to walk over and see this Native American library with you, if that's cool. Yeah. Shamim, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining me.
I had a good time. Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Eclipse, a College of Education podcast from Washington State University.